Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om
10th Canto, Chapter 15. The Killing of Dainuka, the Ass Demon, Text 16. We're starting, I think, maybe from Text 14. Is that it? All right. And 14's on the board. Kvachit krida parishrantam gopat sango pabahanam sayam vishram mayatyayam Parasamvahanadibi. Translation. When his elder brother, fatigued from playing, would lie down with his head upon the lap of a cowherd boy, Lord Krishna would help him relax by personally massaging his feet and offering other services. Purport. The word Parasamvahanadibi indicates that Lord Krishna would massage Balaram's feet, fan him, and bring him river water to drink. Text 15. Sometimes, as the cowherd boys danced, sang, moved about, and playfully fought with each other, Krishna and Balaram, standing nearby hand in hand, would glorify their friends' activities and laugh. Text 16. Sometimes Lord Krishna grew tired from fighting and lay down at the base of a tree, resting upon a bed made of soft twigs and buds and using the lap of a cowherd friend as his pillow. Purport. The word palavatopeshu implies that Lord Krishna expanded himself into many forms and lay down upon the many beds of twigs, leaves, and flowers, hastily constructed by his enthusiastic cowherd friends. We are fortunate by hearing from Shukadeva Goswami to be amidst the Vrindavan forest. And we spoke 2 days ago about how sometimes the opulences of the Vrindavan forest bewilder devotees of Vaikuntha. They don't get it sometimes. How can Krishna be so attracted to such simplicity in Vrindavan? Just think, you're hearing that Krishna would lay down at the base of a tree, resting upon a bed made of soft twigs and buds. How does this compare to the opulences of Vaikuntha? The palaces, the majesty. But as we spoke a few days ago, the main attribute of Vrindavan is madhurya, sweetness. And that is priceless. Remember Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu during the Ratha Yatra festival. He wants to bring Krishna back to Vrindavan. In the mood of Krishna's dearest devotee, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu spoke. Remember the forest, the opulences of Dwarka. They're not where we should be. Kurukshetra is not where we should be. We should be in the forest. Sometimes Srila Prabhupada refers to Vrindavan as the remote cowherd village. How does a remote cowherd village compare to the opulences of Vaikuntha? Yet, in this remote cowherd village, Krishna subordinates himself to his devotee's love. So, as Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Krishna has taken the emotions, the heart of Srimati Radharani, and implored Krishna, come back to the forest of Vrindavan. Come back to that remote cowherd village. Very beautifully, Chaitanya Charitamrita explains this bhava, this Radha bhava. For most people, the mind and the heart are one. But for me, my mind and Vrindavan are one. I wish for you to come back to the forest. Place your lotus feet there. Your placing your lotus feet back in the forest of Vrindavan is the same as your placing your lotus feet in my mind. Because Moramana Vrindavana, my mind and Vrindavan are one. Speaking in the consciousness of Srimati Radharani, Lord Chaitanya would point out to Lord Jagannath, how can you forget Vrindavan? How can you forget your mother, your father, the cowherd boys, the cowherd girls? And then Chaitanya Mahaprabhu would point out the topography, the landscape of Vrindavan. Can you really forget the Jamuna River? Can you really forget Govardhan Hill? Can you really forget all the inhabitants of Vrindavan? When we speak of all the inhabitants of Vrindavan, that's referring to all the living entities, the deer, the birds, the peacocks. How can Krishna forget them? They're all devotees. You may remember earlier in this chapter how when Lord Krishna was noticing the mood of the forest, yes, the Vrindavan forest has a mood because everyone there is a conscious entity. There's no matter. So he noticed that as he entered the forest, the trees were all bowing down, offering their fruits to him, their branches touching the ground. He noticed the vegetation all leaning down, offering obeisances. Of course, Krishna knew it was for him, but he decided humorously to point out to Balaram, they're doing all this for you. Just see Balaram, Krishnagraja, Krishna's elder brother, Balaram, Krishnagraja. Just see Krishnagraja. They're all bowing down to you. They're worshiping you. These trees, they must have been impersonalist in their previous life, and now they're condemned to stand as trees in Vrindavan. Nevertheless, their branches are bowing down to you, Balaram. Actually, in humility, the trees in Vrindavan were thinking themselves unfortunate, even though they're all devotees, but they're thinking themselves unfortunate that they can't wander throughout the forest following Krishna. So that's the inner reality. Every devotee always thinks, I'm not Krishna conscious enough. I'm not chanting Hare Krishna well enough. There's so much more I could do for Krishna. So the trees, though they were devotees, they're thinking like that. Our misfortune is we have to stay in one place. As you know, sometimes the definition for Shantaras is given that the devotee in Shantaras, neutrality, only engages in service when Krishna activates that particular devotee, when he picks the flower, or when he lays under a particular tree. Whereas in Dasya Prema, in love of God, in servitude, the devotee initiates service and also has a sense of mamata, possessiveness. This is my master. I am his servant. That possessiveness is there in the four rasas. Mamata is there in servitude, my master. Mamata is there in friendship, our friend Krishna, have no fear, our friend is here. Mamata is there in, of course, Vatsalya praying, our child Krishna. Even the other elder ladies and men in Vrindavan, not simply Nanda Maharaj and Yashodamayi, Krishna's mother and father, but the other elders, they also felt, Krishna's my child. That's why when Krishna would do some mischief, they would go to report to Mother Yashoda, because they felt this parental possessiveness. And they even felt that, well, if Krishna was my boy, I would treat him as well as Mother Yashoda, if he were my boy. That was their ambition. So therefore, when Brahma thought he had stolen the cowherd boys and calves, Krishna gave all the mothers in Vrindavan a chance to indeed fulfill their desire and have Krishna as their boy, because they were thinking like that. If he were my boy, I'd love him just like Mother Yashoda. This is Vrindavan, the fulfillment of all legitimate desires. And what are legitimate desires? Legitimate desires are simply to satisfy Krishna 100%. So the elder gopis were not thinking, I want to satisfy my senses with Krishna. They were thinking, if Krishna were my boy, I could also take care of him, bathe him, feed him. I could do that. So the mamata is there in Vatsalya Prem, and it's also there in Madhuyaras. Of course, Krishna is my beloved. During the Rath Yatra, Lord Chaitanya, in the mood of Srimati Radharani, is trying to incite Krishna's remembrance of Vrindavan forest and of all the inhabitants. Don't you want to go there? That's the only place where we can be happy. That's the only place where your desires can completely be fulfilled by your loving devotees. Please come back. Please put your feet there. Please return. And Krishna replied, as recorded in Chaitanya Charitamrita. Actually, how could I ever forget the residents of Vrindavan? I can't sleep at night because of them. Forgetting because of being separated from them. So now we are in this forest and we're hearing about Krishna and the cowherd boys play. Just see the services that Krishna is offering to his devotees. First of all, to Balaram. He's helping Balaram relax. Lord Krishna would help him relax by personally massaging his feet and offering other services. Now, you may ask the question, since Balaram is the first expansion of Godhead, and basically speaking, the only difference between Krishna and Balaram is that Balaram is whitish and Krishna is bluish. So how is it then that Krishnagraja, the elder brother of Krishna, is fatigued? And then you'll also hear in text 16, sometimes Lord Krishna grew tired from fighting. Fatigue, tiredness, isn't that a material symptom? You have desire to achieve something, to gain something. You work very hard till you're so exhausted, and then you feel fatigued. And in spite of your hard work and your fatigue, you're fearful because death is coming and you don't know when. So isn't this all about material life, fatigue, tiredness? How is it that Krishna and Balaram are tired? But as you know, this is simply their pastime. Let's enjoy the leela of being tired, and then we can enjoy resting. Let us taste the flawless experience of being tired. No material contamination. No past, present, and future to wear you down. No passage of time. time in the Vrindavan forest is just a stage prop. It just means now it's time for this pastime, now it's time for that pastime. There's no deterioration caused by time. There's no exhaustion or fatigue caused by time. It's just one of those decorations in Vrindavan meant to enhance the pastimes. 2 days ago, we spoke about the planets in the sky in Vrindavan. They don't have any material inauspicious effect. They're spiritual. They're part of the scenery. And they're there just for Krishna's pleasure. The sun shines. Even the sun gets so hot. Still, that's Krishna relishing the hot sun. And then he goes in the shade and he relishes the shade. And the rising of the moon, especially the full moon in the Sharad season. It's all going on for Krishna's pleasure. To stimulate exchanges of ecstatic love. The ordinary person, not trained in parampara, has difficulty with Krishna's lila. Well, he's tired. How can that be God? That's why Krishna first educates you in Bhagavad Gita. Avajananti mamudha. Fools think I'm an ordinary human being. Fools think that I'm actually tired in a material way. Fools think I have some material purpose to accomplish. Boys play with boys because they want to satisfy themselves. They have desires. They want to jump up and down and play to fulfill themselves, to make their childhood perfect. But Krishna has no need to do anything. He engages in his childhood pastimes just because he engages in them. Though he has no need, he does them. Because he is the supreme enjoyer. To be an actual enjoyer, you cannot have any necessity. As soon as necessity is pushing you, that's not enjoyment. Think about it. As soon as you have some purpose to achieve, because there's some lack within you, as soon as there's some pressure, some necessity that you have to do something, you can't enjoy. But material life means you pretend that you're going to enjoy. And you pretend the results have been enjoyable. Even though you've been pressured, you've had your arm twisted, you've been motivated by emptiness within you, deficiency, but you call it a good time. Let me meet with my friends because I'm lonely, because I'm bored. I don't know what to do with myself. So maybe if I meet with my friends, we'll create some pleasure. And of course, you have to tolerate no matter what kind of pleasure, so-called pleasure there is in the material, there's something always to tolerate. Just like when boys play with their friends. You know, there's always some friend who you consider egotistical, who wants to be the center, who wants to lord it over the other boys, or even be a bully. So you have to tolerate if you want to play. Or, according to the Bhagavatam, in home relationships, husband, materially speaking, wants to enjoy the wife. Wife wants to enjoy the husband. But they have to tolerate imbalances, discrepancies. According to the fifth canto, I didn't say it's the fifth canto. The husband has to tolerate being kicked, being plundered. We'll speak about that later, the forest of material enjoyment. Right now we're on the Vrindavan forest. Don't worry. Just speaking Bhagavatam now. Don't shoot the messenger. So try to understand that how can you be the enjoyer and how can there be such a thing as real pleasure in the material world when there's always the force of necessity? when there's always so much pressure from your body and mind to act in a certain way. Or there's the pressure of society, social comparison. So how can you say you're enjoying? You're pushed by internal dynamics and external dynamics. But real enjoyment has no necessity, and Krishna demonstrates that. Why am I playing in the Vrindavan forest? Is it because I'm bored? No, because for no reason at all, except whatever I do is pleasure. I'll enjoy being fatigued, I'll enjoy resting, for no reason. And I'll also, even though I have no reason to do anything, I'll give pleasure to my devotees. And my devotees have no reason to do anything except to please me. Well, this is life on the spiritual platform. In material existence, fatigue is not a pleasant thing. I was experiencing that yesterday as we returned from the Bhaktivedanta hospital. And after being worked over by the fine team of devotee doctors, very eager to show their devotional skills. Because after a while, I was eager to make an exit. That's natural. enough medical things. Enough. So anyway, we're coming back from the hospital and driving on that, what is that road? Huh? Santa Cruz Highway. Yeah. And traffic comes to a complete halt. You know, was it four lanes on one side? A complete, there's nothing moving. And just sat there and sat there. 1 hour, hour and a half. What's going on? There's some political party making a demonstration. Block the highway. 2 hours are just stuck there. Still the traffic's not moving. Finally, we inched forward a little bit and were able to get off the highway and had to come through the city. So tiring. Not a pleasant experience. What are you going to do? Stuck on the Santa Cruz Highway for 2 hours, not going anywhere. Just you're already tired. These are the inconveniences of material existence. Of course, things could be a lot worse. Fortunately, I had good association, Gopinath Prasad Prabhu, and he was trying his best to come up with a solution. But, you know, he didn't have an internet connection, so he couldn't get online and research a solution. He had to figure it out for himself. But he did call on his mobile. He called Nityananda Priya. What to do? Oh, Gauranga Priya. Gauranga Priya. He said, later, Gopinath Prasad said, Gauranga Priya gave the perfect answer. What to do? Just wait, I'll call back in a few minutes. That's always the perfect answer. I'll get back to you. In other words, what do you want out of me? I can't unblock the traffic. But still, as a humble, you know, respectful Vaishnavi, okay, just give me a few minutes. I'll get back to you. So he must have quickly researched the situation, Gauranga Priya, and he got back to Gopinath Prasad that, you know, they're blocking both sides of the motorway. So it's not that we can send a car from the temple coming the other way and pick you up. But they block both sides. It was very exhausting. So this is material existence, and things could get a lot worse. We get tired. There are impediments. But for Krishna's pastimes, there's nothing like that. And it's very difficult for a person with ordinary intelligence to understand. Because everything done in the material is based on necessity, need, some lack, something's missing, you have to fill the gap. Relationships are built in that way, fill the gap, fill the hole. But for Krishna, his lila, of course, by definition, has nothing to do with goals to achieve, purposes to fulfill. Everything is just his own sweet pleasure. Whatever Krishna feels like doing simply because he feels like it. And this is what we're envious of. Supposedly, very rich people, they can operate like that, do something just because they feel like it. But as we know, they're under the gun of so many mental and physical demands, necessities. Bhagavad Gita trains us to understand that Krishna, namam karmani limpati, he has nothing that he needs to have. He's got no fruits to pursue. Therefore, he's not an ordinary person. His fatigue is just, he's relishing that experience of apparently being fatigued. But his body is all spiritual. There's no question of exhaustion. But as a Supreme Personality of Godhead, to show you he can enjoy everything, he also shows you, I can enjoy fatigue. I've played, now I'm tired. I'll put my head at the base of a tree, resting upon a bed made of soft twigs and buds, and using the lap of a cowherd friend as his pillow. He's showing that. And by these activities, he's attracting those who have forgotten him. This is real life. Come back to this. But it takes preparation to understand Krishna's Vrindavan Leela. Therefore, there are nine cantos of Bhagavatam preceding. So you don't view these activities with material vision. One time, Srila Prabhupada just said to his disciples, he stunned them a bit, he said, I wonder how many of my disciples actually accept Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Are you just being theistical? I believe in God, I believe there's a higher power. So, yeah. Krishna makes the most sense as the highest power. That is true, but that's not, of course, a deep understanding. The deep understanding involves realizing that there's nothing beyond Krishna's leelas. There's nothing beyond that. Those leelas are factual, they are for real, and the process is given by which you can enter into them. So that is more than just being theistic, accepting Krishna's leelas. And just to show you how he reciprocates with every devotee without fail, just to show you that he's a chuta, the deep meaning of a chuta is he's infallible in that he's perfect in exchanging rasa. Whether Senyo Ubayo Maje, Racham Stapaya Maitruta, whether Arjuna is asking, please, Achyuta, drive my chariot in between the two armies. He's Achyuta in that way, in his friendship relationship with Arjuna. He's Achyuta in all the relationships with the devotees. This is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, far beyond any understanding of the Supreme as the creator, maintainer, destroyer. Not satisfied with Krishna's pastimes in Vrindavan, what do we get? The the forest of material enjoyment. Very beautiful two chapters to study in the fifth canto. Explained by Judd Barrett to Maharaj Rahugana. And that was Judd Barrett's mercy. You see, at first, Judd Barrett, the Shastra describes, was a little upset with Maharaj Rahugana, who had insulted him. You imbecile, you dullard, why are you carrying my chariot, my palanquin, rather? Why are you carrying my palanquin in such a haphazard way? Have you no brains? Are you weak? You're too old? Speaking sarcasm like that. So the Shastra describes that waves of dissatisfaction had manifested in Judd Barrett because he has a material body. But he controlled that. Remember what Krishna explains in the second chapter of Bhagavad Gita. Apuryamana achala pratishta samudrama pravashanti. Just like so many rivers pour into the ocean, but the ocean does not cross its limits, except when there's global warming. So, but you see, it's an abnormal civilization that has global warming, so therefore you cannot say, oh, that verse, there's a problem with it. No. The verse is using an analogy based on a real human society in which they don't destroy their own habitat. This is the great paranoia in places like New York City, you know, Manhattan. They're realizing that the ocean is going to rise. The ice caps, the polar ice caps are melting. But due to avariciousness and greed, the predominant concern among those in the know, the predominant concern for the melting of the Arctic ice cap is what? Look at all the natural resources that are becoming revealed now that the ice is melting. Who's going to get all those resources? If you're greedy, you're greedy. That's your predominant mentality. Okay, so the ice is melting and the oceans may rise and the ocean may cover low-lying areas, whether Bangladesh or New York City. All right. We've got enough money to protect ourselves. Who's going to get all the natural resources that the melted ice, the thawed ice has revealed? That's what they're thinking. And of course, sooner or later, they'll fight over it. You have now Japan and China brandishing war talk over a few insignificant islands. Such conflicts have to arise in a situation, in a world in which everyone is vying to be the enjoyer. That's the forest of material enjoyment. In one purport in that chapter, Forest of Material Enjoyment, Srila Prabhupada explains that you cannot live honestly in the material world. Sooner or later, you'll compromise your own principles. You'll take leave of your own moral principles. Generally, persons who think they're good, they always have some personal standard. You know, I would never do this, or I would never do that. And then you can always look down on someone who, you know, doesn't act according to your personal code. But sooner or later, in the material world, everyone becomes embarrassed that in order to survive or fulfill a need or protect yourself, you have to take leave from your own personal standard of moral principles. That's the way it is. This is why the Yamadutas, in talking to the Vishnudutas, in defending themselves, because the Vishnudutas were saying, why are you taking this person? So Yamadutas had to clarify their mission statement. Hey, this is what we are about. We take persons like Ajamil. We take anyone who is broken, who has broken dharmic principles. And they explain, the Yamadutas explain, actually, you're asking us to explain who is a fit candidate for punishment in the material world and who is not? We'll tell you the truth. Here's the bottom line. Sooner or later, we get everyone in the material world. Because sooner or later, you're going to slip up. whether in this life or the next, whether on this planet or that planet, sooner or later you're going to slip up, and we'll be there. We'll be there for you. So that they explain like that. You may be pious in this birth, fine, we'll wait. Sooner or later you're going to see us, because that's the way the material world's arranged. So they said, actually, everyone in the material world is a candidate for us. It's just a matter of time. It's the way the material world is constructed. It's rigged that you'll have problems. And Krishna warns you in Bhagavad Gita, but you don't believe him. Oh, it's not that bad. Krishna says, Dukkhalayam Ashashvatam, just to scare us. In India, do the parents, they try to scare their children into behaving and not being naughty by saying, you know, some monster's going to get you? Yeah? They say it like that? What do they call the monster? Huh? In English-speaking countries, they say the boogeyman is... The parents say, you better behave or the boogeyman is going to get you. So we may think that Krishna is just trying to frighten us. He has good intentions, of course. But he's trying to frighten us by saying there's just misery in the material world. It's not that bad. There's something in us that causes us to respond in that way. Even we go through some suffering, yet still we have hope. I shall enjoy. By hearing Krishna's leelas, we are embarrassed to think, how could I ever try to be the enjoyer? How could I ever think to compete with Krishna? Where did this madness come from? So Judd Barrett, because he had a material body, even though he was a great sage, he felt waves of dissatisfaction in his mind due to the insults of Rahugana. But he calmed himself, just like the ocean. The Shastra says, just like the ocean, after showing some waves, the ocean becomes calm and peaceful. Similarly, Judd Barrett became calm and peaceful. So, again, Apuryamana Upchalapratishta. Rivers may pour into the ocean, but the ocean, normally speaking, doesn't cross its limits. Similarly, desires may certainly come to the devotee who is striving for freedom from material existence. But because the devotee is full in devotional service, he's not capsized by those desires. You see, the material body and mind have a history. They're the product of a chain of actions and reactions, so we can't be sentimental about it. We're carrying with us a bag of complexities and intricacies from many lifetimes. So sometimes, even in spite of our best desires, our bodies and minds throw things at us due to past conditioning. So Krishna, who's very, very expert, the topmost expert in psychology and tactics, he says, look, this is just like rivers pour into the ocean. Similarly, desires may come to the candidate for liberation, but don't act on those desires. And how can you not act on those desires? Because you're full in devotional service. Our ambition is to always think of Krishna. We spoke about that 2 days ago. Every devotee should maintain that ambition to always think of Krishna, to think, feel, and will in pure devotion. But en route to that, sometimes our conditioning kicks at us. And that's where tolerance is required. And tolerance is based on knowledge. What does Prahlad Maharaj say? Kandutivan manasijam vishaheta dira. Someone who is dira, sober, tolerates the itch of material desires and avoids so much suffering. So toleration is a part of bhakti. But if you want to live a material life, you have to have tolerance. So what is unusual about tolerating, then, in bhakti? Tolerance is a universal quality that's necessary to do anything in this world. But tolerating for the sake of material purposes is such a waste, whereas tolerating for Krishna's pleasure gives you the highest result, the highest goal. So it's not like non-devotees don't have to tolerate. Their life is full of toleration. But because they think, I'm going to get something for me, they overlook the toleration, or it seems to make sense to them. Yeah, what's wrong with tolerating this or that when at the end of the day, I'm going to get this? So that enjoying mentality propels you forward to endure so much abuse. And this is pointed out by Judd Bart to Rahugana Maharaj. And remember that Rahugana Maharaj, before this chapter, these two chapters about the forest of material enjoyment, before they started, Rahugana Maharaj had already plunged down from his palanquin onto the ground, dandavats at the feet of Judd Bart. So Judd Bart was pacified and began to reward him with transcendental knowledge. So before Judd Bart began to explain about this allegory, the forest of material enjoyment, he explained to Rahugana Maharaj two things. There's asanga and there's susanga. Bhakti is about both. Asanga means detachment from material activities. And susanga means attachment to the association of devotees. So Judd Bharat had given him that instruction. This is what you should do, Rahugana Maharaj. This is where you should go. Asanga and susanga. And just to exemplify that Siddhanta, Judd Bharat is going to embellish with the allegory of the forest of material existence, which obviously is an allegory. And there are allegories in Srimad Bhagavatam. The Puranjana story, an allegory spoken by Narada Muni to King Prachina Bharata. It's an obvious one. We have to be very careful in dealing with things in Srimad Bhagavatam that are beyond our understanding. It's so easy for our little tiny brain to say, oh, that's allegory. That is just metaphorical. Which is a nice way of saying it's a myth. We have to be very careful. Because paramo namatsaranam satam, the Bhagavatam is meant for liberated persons who are completely free from envy. Sometimes devotees ask, well, how do we know what's factual in Bhagavatam and what is allegorical? This question was brought up to Srila Prabhupada. He said, generally, everything in Bhagavatam is factual, but there are allegories there, and to know what are those allegories, you have to be a liberated soul. Oh, we said, oh, that's not fair. You know, what do you mean it's not fair? You have to come to a certain standard. That's all he's saying. No. There's just Hindu taboos. We should be able to understand everything right now based on where we're at now. That's real knowledge. But as I often explain, parampara knowledge is state-specific. According to your state of consciousness, that determines what you can understand. Whereas the Western principle is that what you can understand has nothing to do with your personal qualities or behavior. You can just do anything, act in any way. Still, your intellect remains pristine and competent. So therefore, a professor can act in any way he likes, but he becomes an expert in a particular field. And one of those fields is Hinduism or Krishna or Chaitanya. So these are just fair game for mundane intellect. And what does my personal behavior have to do with my ability to understand Lord Chaitanya? Bengali social reformer, did some good, and then lost the plot the last part of his life. That's what they say. They admit that there was a person, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. But they just see him as a social reformer who, British Christian historians, they say, yes, there was. In the history of Jagannath Puri, there was a Chaitanya, and he did great work speaking for egalitarianism and breaking the caste system. But then, the last part of his life, he just went mad. That's what they say. I have read. That's what they say. In other words, he started out great. He started out mundane. But then, he just lost himself in these mad ecstasies. So the material intelligence thinks everything is fair game. I don't need to upgrade my consciousness. But the Parampara system is something else. Knowledge is state specific. As Krishna tells Arjuna in Bhagavad Gita, Sevaya Maya Chaja Yoga Prota Paratana Bhakto Sime Sakha Cheti Rahasyam Hitarutama. Arjuna, you can comprehend what I'm saying because you're my devotee and you're my friend. Therefore, you can understand these great mysteries. So the mundane intellect will say, what does it matter that someone's your devotee or friend? That's got nothing to do with it. That's got nothing to do with the empirical process, the laboratory procedure. But Bhagavad Gita presents another way of understanding and a more effective way. What else does Krishna say in Bhagavad Gita? Pravakshan yanasuyave ganam vigana sahitam yajgatva moksha shubat. Because you're not envious of me. Just listen, I'm going to teach you how to get out of material existence because you're not envious of me. So indeed we become envious because we say, what does it matter, Krishna, how I think about you? You just give me what I want. It doesn't matter how I think about you or feel about you in terms of my understanding. Let's be scientific, Krishna. But Krishna has another definition of being scientific. It all depends on the quality of your consciousness. Now, if you're a mundaner, then you should be honest. Okay, you say it's all about the quality of my consciousness. Well, I guess that ends the discussion because I don't know what consciousness is. No, they won't say that. They'll insist sometimes. What does it matter? We don't know what consciousness is. That has nothing to do with life. It has nothing to do with how you live your life and what we can understand. So this is the difference in comprehension according to Parampara and comprehensive according to mundane understanding, which is so prevalent today. Behave any way you like, but your intellect is unaffected. But if you listen to Krishna, oh, then you have intellectual deterioration because you are accepting something that cannot be verified in the laboratory. No, Krishna offers a laboratory. He offers that. But it's on his terms. And this is what we don't like. It's on his terms. Here is the procedure. You go into the laboratory and you can verify. Well, why is that the procedure? Just because you say? This is the envy. All you have to do is take what Krishna says and apply it in the bhakti laboratory. But the big hang-up is, well, why should I do it just because Krishna says? Who is Krishna anyway? Why does Krishna have the right to dictate? Well, he's only the supreme enjoyer. And look at you. What happens when you try to go enjoy in the forest? The mosquitoes are biting you, and the sun is too hot, it can rain, fierce animals may stalk you. You go with your friends, you have a big argument, You go with your girlfriend and she breaks up with you in the middle of the forest. Oh, this is life. This is what happened. Yet we become so proud, we cannot listen to Krishna. And because of that pride, we can't understand Krishna Leela. I remember, I had just finished university, and I was starting to read Prabhupada's books. I especially relished Krishna book. So one of my associates, I thought, I'll let this person see the Krishna book. So the person just took, also the person was, you know, Yale graduate, you know, the pinnacle of civilization. So the person took the book, and at that time in the front pages of the book, there was just a page with just a few words on it, right in the front. It said, Krishna is the supreme enjoyer. So a person opened the book. I said, hey, check this out. Look at this. This is the greatest book I've ever read. Krishna, the supreme enjoyer. Spontaneous reaction. Like, what is this nonsense? We are the enjoyers. That was the reaction. Just immediately, first contact with Krishna. Krishna, the supreme enjoyer. That's our job. What is this sectarian nonsense? So that envy goes so deep. And therefore, when we read Judd Bart's speaking to Rahugana, we may feel some resistance. Oh, come on, it's not that bad. You know, the Bhagavatam is just trying to, you know, slow us down a bit, you know, but it's not that bad. But you should read those two chapters. Just to make sure you don't have any misunderstanding, the allegory takes up two chapters. One is more, how do we say, allegorical. The other is really nailing it. Make sure you don't miss the point. Because Rahugana Maharaj, after the first chapter, says, I sort of understand, but can you give me some clarification? And so then in the second chapter, Judd Bart doesn't pull any punches, so to speak. Yeah. Of course, in both chapters, due to his purports, Prabhupada makes sure you get the point in both chapters. Prabhupada understands the level of intelligence in Kali Yuga. Well, some people say, you know, well, you know, think about Prabhupada's books, they're not so subtle. and sometimes he repeats himself. Why is that? What do you mean, why is that? It's because you're so dull. He knows it. If it is the fact that you assimilated the point, then let us see the change in your life. But we don't see the change in your life. That means you didn't get the point. So therefore, Prabhupada repeats it. Why? Purport after purport, you're not the body. Because you still haven't understood it. So, whenever you're feeling like you have some faith in material existence, you read those two chapters, The Forest of Material Enjoyment. A merchant goes to the forest looking for natural resources. These days, you'd say like a nation goes looking for oil or titanium or uranium. You know, without those strategic essentials, your nation's finished these days. You know, the U.S. military knows all about that. What are they doing invading Iraq? Democracy, to bring democracy. No. Iraq was a perfect situation. They could make a military base on top of oil wells. It doesn't get any better than that. A military base perfectly situated in the Middle East on top of oil wells underneath. That's what every army wants. Strategic positioning and resources right under the ground. So that's the same principle as the merchant going to the forest looking for some valuable minerals, forest products. And in the course of going into that forest, the merchant suffers so many tribulations. But because his mind is fixed on getting what he wants, he undergoes all these tribulations. So the chapters are full of descriptions of how you're always attacked by envious persons. You hear them in the bushes of the forest, you just hear voices. You're being bitten by their envious comments, like you're being bitten by mosquitoes. You're being devoured by jackals and tigers. Describing material household life, in which the husband comes home from a hard day at work and his wife and children literally plunder him. They take all his money. And he feels responsible and satisfied in that way. Oh, they've taken all my money. There's a description of material household life. The dangers that one will willfully accept in order to pursue sense gratification. Just beautifully described. The hopes that you have in the forest of material enjoyment, and then the realities. Krishna, as Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, is especially inviting us back to the forest of Vrindavan. Where perfect cooperation with Krishna is the foundation. Cooperation is the basis of love. And then on that platform of perfect harmony and cooperation, real ecstasy can be felt. So in the beginning stages of bhakti, we learn how to cooperate with Krishna, how to harmonize with Krishna's desire. That's what the guru is teaching. This is Krishna's desire. Let us harmonize with it. And then, once you are able to cooperate with Krishna's desire, then you can start to advance in deeper feelings for Krishna. And Krishna will talk to you. Tesham sata yuktanam bhajatam priti purvakam. When you're serving me constantly with priti, affection, I'll give you customized instructions how to go back to Godhead. Tailored for your individual situation. The general instructions are good enough, but because you're following the general instructions, I'll even make it more fine-tuned and more personal just to deepen our relationship. That is achyuta, infallible in the exchange of rasa with his devotees. All right, any questions? Yes.
Raj, you can see that it seems that the Jada Parvas.
It can seem that Jada Parvas, because he was not preaching before he met Rahugana Maharaj. So he was with his family, he met so many people, but he was not preaching. So what made the switch, what made the turn that he actually preached to Rahugana Maharaj?
It is difficult to calculate the mercy of a saintly person. You could say it's by accident. Just like when you read about the wanderings, Shishi Radha Gopina. When you read about the wanderings of Narada Muni, sometimes the Shastra will say, by chance, Narada Muni came upon this one or that one. But actually, there is no, that's not chance as known in Kali Yuga, just blind chance. No, everything has a purpose. Krishna has arranged the universe so that conditioned souls will come across, they'll cross the path of a saintly person. So, Judd Barrett felt inspired to instruct Rahugana Maharaj. Even though Rahugana Maharaj had made such a sarcastic, biting beginning. But in the beginning, please remember, in his instruction to Rahugana Maharaj, Judd Bart didn't speak in a completely transparent way. He just spoke enough knowledge that Rahugana Maharaj realized his mistake. Ooh, I've offended a great personality. And at that point, Rahugana Maharaj fell onto the ground, dandavats, and asked for clarification. And because he fell on the ground at Judd Bart's feet and asked for clarification, Judd Bart began to explain more and answered all the points that Rahugana Maharaj wasn't clear about. So you could say it's by accident. I was just listening to Prabhupada the other day explaining that materialists don't do anything good. If the only way they do something good is by accident. Otherwise, they don't do anything good. The Prabhupada knows how to arouse us. You know, like, ooh, such a blanket statement. How could it be true? But he wants you to think how it could be true. He's provoking you. They don't do anything good except by accident. It's the only time they do something good. And so devotees, they were curious. Well, can you explain? What do you mean by accident? He said, yeah, sometimes they don't intend to do something good, but sometimes good happens. For example, he said, he was speaking in USA, it's an accident. They didn't know what I was up to, what I was doing, but they let me come to this country and preach. It was an accident. They didn't know, but they let it happen. So they did something good by accident. So think about that. Let be provoked by those words. They don't do anything good. Only good they do is by accident, unintentionally. They let some devotees do something. Anything else? Someone wants to say something, or will... Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.